Hang on a second.
Hey, was banana hammock in? Did he make it into the Grixis control list last week?
Banana hammock? Oh, you mean Tassinger?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Banana hammock. Hey, I'm recording right now, by the way.
Oh, good.
Oh, okay. Well, so should we just blaze it?
Should we just blaze it? Yeah.
Let's blaze it.
Hey, welcome to Card Knock Life. This is our third episode, going with the theme of threes here, there are just three Caballeros in the room. John Galley. Yeah, Three's Company, so we're good. We're down a Shuming Chen as well, because they are... Brandon, what are they doing?
They're actually off fighting the Dragons of Tarkir.
Yeah, or at work or something, but we had a last-minute switch of times because of the championship NCAA basketball game.
Yeah, important sports ball game or something, I don't know.
Go sports ball. We're going to all try to make it to that, so this is going to be a shortened one today, but we've got a lot to talk about, so let's get started right away. Going through some tournament reports, let's start in Standard.
And, let's do it.
Of course, the big Standard event this weekend was the SCG Open, which Chris Van Meter won with GR Aggro. Which is kind of a misnomer. If you look at this list, man, there's like it's actually kind of a ramp deck more than anything. It's got Xenagos, three Xenagos in there, and ramps into like things as big as Dragonlord Atarka, which I'm kind of happy to see this guy in here.
I don't understand why they just don't call this deck Green Red Monsters.
Yeah,
I mean, or Green Red Mid Range. It's because that's what it is, the mid range deck. Like it's Draconic War, so it's just like Syrian Blood, Syrian Blaze, Critters Claws. Okay, yeah, this is just like Green Red Monsters or Green Red. Green Red Ramp. This looks, I mean, kind of like a deck. This is something I thought of, like, as far as a dragon-based strategy with Dragonlord Ataka. Like, you could play, like, 7 Siege and play, like, Outpost Siege and Citadel Siege. Because then Citadel Siege on Frontier Siege.
Yeah.
Because Frontier Siege on dragons, playing Dragonlord Arcana or whatever his name is, Ataka. I suck at words. All right. but yeah, playing that guy, fighting something for 8, like it's a bunch of removal spells because you have explosive vegetation to go from 4 to 6 to 7. So you can either play Frontier Siege to go to 7 if you just want to play a dragon, or you can go explosive vegetation into a dragon. You can easily play a bunch of these mana accelerants to go turn 3 siege, turn 4 dragon, or something to that effect. So there's a lot of kind of flexibility here with this ramp strategy.
Of course, his ramp package is just the Elvish Mystic, Sylvan Caryatid, Corsair of Crufix plan, and Xenagos. I love this Xenagos, man. I'm surprised it doesn't get played more. I've been running this guy all throughout Standard. That ramp ability is insanely good sometimes. It's better than having a Nykthos in play in a lot of cases.
Well, a lot of times also, like, there weren't a ton of big threats that you want to ramp into, especially when that guy came out. There wasn't anything that was strong enough to play Xenagos, have like mana guy, Corsair in play, untap, play a land, be at 7 or be at 5 mana, plus that guy go to 8 mana. There wasn't really a threat.
Well,
now you have threats. Now you have like the Dragon Lords. You have Ugin if you're willing to like give up some board presence or start bolting things. So now you have these 7 and 8 mana spells that are actually worth playing, because the only payoff we had for a while was Hornet Queen. Now we have these big dragons to just crush our opponent with.
Well, I think the most common was the monstrous sun on Stormbreath, the 7 mana.
Yeah, I mean,
you're
not playing that guy and then like attacking him for 5 with it. You're playing an 8-8 now instead of a 4-4 haste, so.
Before we move on from this one, just notice there's one Mob Rule in the sideboard. I think that's pretty awesome. Basically like a small Insurrection, 6 mana. Choose one, gain control of all creatures with power 4 or greater until end of turn. Untap them, they get haste, or power 3 or less. it seems like a pretty sweet blowout for like a Falter effect in the skies.
Is this like for the mirror?
I guess so. That's my guess. I mean,
you can actually board this in when you become the control deck, because if you bring in the Hornet's Nest, the Wild Slashes, the Mob Rule, the Roast, and the Seismic Ruptures, you become a control deck, and you Seismic Rupture them to keep their board small, and then like when they get to the point where it's like Fleecemane Lion and Siege Rhino and like larger creatures, you have your creatures, you cast Mob Rule, you take their creatures, and you attack them with everything. Because I'm pretty sure that you untap them and they get haste. So it's like an actual insurrection for six mana. It's just like, I would like all of your Siege Rhinos and things that look like it attack you for a bunch. So.
And you can do the three or less and get all the Hornet Queen tokens as well, which are going to block the heck out of you with all your flyers.
You'll also notice that if you have like 10 or 15 mana, like when the games go really long in these like green ramp decks, you can take control of all the creatures of power 4 or greater, which means the Dragon Lord Tarkas that you just played, or your Thunderbreak Regents that you just cast, or your Ashcloud Phoenixes that you just cast, get haste, and you can attack with them as well. So that's not something to be kind of written off as another thing to notice about the card.
Cool. Yeah, this is a cool deck. I mean, there's a lot of this in the top 8.
Yeah, just all these mid-range ramp decks is what it looks like. Because I didn't think they named them all Abs and Aggro, but they're probably very mid-rangey. Okay, here's actual aggro. Right, Death Dealer and Offenza. But yeah, nothing really surprising in any of these cards. There's some Dromoka's Commands floating around, stuff like that.
They're still only running two Dromoka's Command. I don't know about that number.
I mean, the other two are in the sideboard.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, you're going to get to four. But yeah, I think there are much more interesting decks that we can talk about kind of down this list. I know that, Corey, you tabbed one in ninth place by Gerard Fabiano as something you were interested in.
Yeah, before we hit that, though, really quickly, seventh place is a Bant Heroic deck, which the Heroic deck seemed to splash that like third color for like one card now, and that one card is now Dromoka's Command, and this one, and there are four of them. Apparently it's that good. It is literally the only green card in the deck and side.
So yeah, you can put a counter on your guy and then make one of your guys fight theirs. So that's two heroic triggers.
Right, right.
Oh, is it two heroic triggers?
Yeah, it targets two guys that you want.
It is two heroic triggers. Wow. I didn't even think of that. I was just like, you have a 10-10. I'm going to make my 10-10 fight your 5-5.
Or it's like a two mana, right. God's willing. It can stop damage to your dude.
Yeah, it stops Searing Spear and... Anger of the Gods, I think, are the two, or Stoke the Flames are the three big ones that you'll see. And if the game goes long enough and your guy's not a 5-5, then you can stop Dragonlord Urtarka. Or no, you can't stop Urtarka because it's a creature. Well, like, I think it's a lot of that you'll see is the new Searing Blood effect, the 3 to a creature, 3 to you, if they show you a dragon. You know, stuff like that will definitely get shut down early by Dromoka's Command.
I like the mana base. There's only one forest because they are – I think they're already running the four mana confluence, aren't they? Or if not, they've got two or three of them in there. So that was a pretty easy slot in there. And then the four Windswept Heath fetch out the forest or just kind of thin your deck a little bit for planes.
Yeah, I mean, you just essentially adapt your mana base that you were playing for Jeskai Heroic. You don't have a dual land anymore in Mystic Monastery, but you are picking up Windswept Heath as your mana fixer. So you just swap monasteries for Windswept Heath. They play the mountain, you play the forest. It's just a pretty standard swap there. Okay. It's just interesting to see that he decided on zero temples of other color, like zero temple of mystery or temple of plenty.
And then skipping ahead, we can check out the Fabiano list, which is in ninth place, just outside of the top eight. It is a Jund mid-range deck. This is pretty awesome. I'm going to kind of go through it real fast. We got some one Hornet Queen, three Satyr Wayfinder, one Soul of Innistrad, four Sylvan Caryatid, of course, four Courser of Kruphix, one Doomwake, one Dragonlord Urtarka, two CDC, the Fetch CDC, two Tassigar, one Garrick Apex Predator, one Ugin, two Xenagos, three Outpost Siege, three Heroes Downfall, three Murderous Cut, one Whip, and four Thoughtseize. And then, of course,
some number of lands, temples, Urborg.
Right, right.
You know, standard stuff.
This looks pretty fun. It's a big Jund deck. It's no, like, no aggro strategy here.
So I think, like, I don't know why a lot of these people are playing big Jund and just leaving Explosive Vegetation on the sideline. And it might just be that, like, turn three, go from four to six is too slow, but people were excited to go from four to six on turn three with Frontier Siege. So it might just be that the Explosive Vegetation is a better Frontier Siege, because if they kill your Frontier Siege, you have nothing. And if you Explosive Vegetation, you're still at six, seven. And then when they Wrath your board, you're not falling behind again. You're still at four or five and able to kind of continue putting the pressure on your mana. I like this a lot of Outpost Siege. That's something that I think you'll see a lot of in the mid-range decks, is like things get bigger and bigger. You'll either see people try and go under with the aggro decks that were winning, or you'll see people just play Outpost Siege to try and draw extra cards and just bury their opponents in card advantage.
Right. Cool. And then skipping way ahead, you have to go all the way out to 24th place for the like first control list. I'm telling you, man, it's a lot of aggro. I don't know if it's a good thing or just a sign of a new format. But this is where the Narsets come in. There are three in this main deck. This is Nicholas Rippard. Is that how you say that name? So I'm guessing. We've got some Dragonlord Ojutais, two of them main deck, two Silumgard Drifting Death main deck, three Narsets, and then your control suite, four Digs, four Dissolve, four Downfalls, four Silumgard Scorn, two Ultimate Price, two Utterin, three Crux, two Anticipate, two Bioblight. Now, what do you guys think of Silumgar Scorn in there? That's when you have to reveal a dragon to make it not just a four spike.
I think that's great. Well, with four dragons, I don't know. Maybe.
You need nine to reliably hit that dragon on turn two. But a lot of times, turn two, four spiking your opponent is perfect.
Yeah.
Like turn two on the draw. They're trying to play it because they're going to try and go like carry added three drop or carry added into Courser, hold my land drop, play my land after Courser. You're going to get people a lot more often in days than you would expect. And then along the way, you're eventually going to anticipate into a Dragonlord Ojutai or dig through time and take like a removal spell and Ojutai or Slumgar. And so you've just got eight counter spells now, three mana to go along with your kind of removal spell control suite. Interesting to see that, because if you just look at this deck, other than a few of the sideboard cards and the five finishers, Ojutai and Narset, this is a blue-black control deck. Like, this is... I think the Ojutai's command on the sideboard is a little out of place, but it looks like there's just a huge... He's saying that the cards to splash for here are Narset and Dragonlord Ojutai, which, I mean, given that you have End Hostilities and Crux of Fate in the format, both are kind of black-black and white-white respective wraths, sort of what do you want to be? Do you want to be everything, or can you say, all right, I'll let the dragons live or the non-dragons live? Depending on the matchup, that might be kind of awkward, but,
right.
I mean, it lets you...
Just banking on landing a dragon and going Crux of Fate.
Yeah, yeah, like, turn five dragon, turn six Crux of Fate, attack you with Dragon Lord Ojutai or Slumgar or like something like that. But yeah, Narset, like, I mean, 30 targets it doesn't hit, 29 that it does, that's fine. Like, you're going to hit, because you're playing lands and things, you're going to probably hit coin flips all the way through the game. The sideboard, nothing really. Like, the Ojutai's commands, sounds awkward.
He's got your, Brandy's got your Dragon Lord's prerogative in there. It starts now.
there's a single Dragon Lord's prerogative. Yeah. He decided that he didn't have enough draw spells.
And Ojutai's command must come. Sorry, go on.
Buy low, sell high.
Buy low, sell high. Yeah, that's right. Run one in the sideboard, that's going to spike it. There's a single Ojutai's command, that's what I'm trying to say, in the sideboard. It must come in with the Nyx Fleece Ram, right? Is that an option for your two cost guy to return from the yard?
That's the only two cost guy to from the yard.
Is that the plan?
So like, it has to come in like in the same matchups that Nyx Fleece Ram is coming in.
Yeah.
But like, so you're like trying to like counter target Siege Rhino, draw a card, or like draw a card, gain four life against the burn decks. So like, it just feels like this card is out of place. It's trying to be flexible against a bunch of matchups, and so I guess that's fine. But like, you're still only playing a card with three modes on it. It's better than like all the other like commands in this deck. Like, the blue black one is just awful for this deck, so it's fine, but it's the one card in the sideboard I question. I would expect to do something different next week.
All right, should we skip to modern? Are you guys done with standard?
Yeah, I'm done with
yeah
standard.
All right, let's go deep. I'm just kidding. All right, modern, this was won by James Harrod with Affinity, and it's a pretty stock Affinity list. Looking through it, nothing to write home about. Circle Protection Red in the sideboard. Is that happening?
Makes sense. Have you ever played against Burn?
Not with Affinity.
I mean, they kill you on turn four, and you have eight cards that make mana of any color,
yeah,
and Sobel and Glimmer Void, and you can get away with like using your Springleaf Realm to do it too.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would ask, is the basic land in his deck a Plains?
No, it's an island.
No.
Okay, that's kind of sketchy then. I would say if that basic land was a Plains, then sure, yeah, you could get away with the old Circle of Protection Red. But yeah, it's just like you have to not have your creatures die to burn, and you have to not get just crushed by like lava spike, bolt, like searing blood, your guy, searing blaze, your guy. You just can't like, you can't get run over by that. So,
but, I mean, you
have to have circle protection red.
Circle protection red has to activate with a colorless mana, but you only have to cast it with the white. So,
oh, I was thinking of story circle. I'm sorry, I was thinking of story. Yeah.
So this, I mean, this seems really good. I didn't realize it was modern legal. That's cool.
Yeah. All the
circle. What do you guys like more, warmth or circle of protection?
Warmth is not modern legal. Circle protection is.
No.
So I like circle protection.
All right.
I guess I even forgot that circle protection red was modern legal. What set was it in?
Well, it shows up the 7th edition one, which I think it must be in 8th edition. It's 8th is new border, right?
I think so. Let me take a look.
Okay.
I'll do some investigative journalism. We can continue on.
All right, right on. Looking ahead, I had the second place deck pin because it looked pretty sweet. It is a GW Hate Bears. I think these Hate Bears decks look really fun to play, not so much to play against. But this one actually goes big for some like main deck Thrawn, which is pretty awesome. There is a Linvala main deck. It's got Teeg in it, which hits, what, non-creature spells that can mana cost 4, plenty of things. But does the X really
matter? Sphinx's Revelation is a card in modern. Okay. I mean, that's pretty much it as far as X is concerned.
Okay.
Like, Lightning Storm only costs 3 mana. Okay.
Ghazali Pride Mage is in this one main deck. That's got to be, like, my favorite modern card. I love that guy. He's so utility.
Just a very good creature, I think. Let me see if there's anything. I'm not a huge fan of the Leonin Arbiter Ghost Quarter plan. Some people really like it.
Yeah.
I think you have to play like 25 lands to make that go because you still have to cast your spells. Because if you don't draw Aether Vial, then you just don't do anything with this deck. Because you're trying to like strip mine them and wasteland them. So like Ghost Quarter is not Rashad in port, kids. You cannot just like, oh, I'll pay a mana and then, oh, I'll make your land go away for a little bit. Like it's not... That flexibility isn't there. You're like, you either get a land or you don't. Like, right. You have to pick.
He doubles down, though, the Mind Sensor and the Arbiter.
Hey, that's fair.
And Path. He's got Path. I mean, Path works, Ghost Quarter works, Tech Edge works. I think that's kind of the deck design is all about.
Oh, yeah, I guess he is playing 4 Haven Mind Sensor. I said most of these decks I've seen only play like 2, and so I wasn't really behind it. But yeah, 4, I guess I can get behind playing Ghost Quarter then, yeah.
I still agree with you there, though, Daryl. It still doesn't feel like a Rashad in port to me.
So I asked this question because I look at this deck. Is this not a collected company deck? This seems like a deck where instead of playing like, I mean, Aether Vial is insane and everything because it gives you like free guys, but like you could still play these guys like one by one by one and like crush your opponent under the weight of them. And then instead of playing Aether Vial and being behind in the mid game when you run out of guys, you could just collected company them and put 2 other really powerful guys in the play.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's funny you say that because the 11th place deck is kind of made me think that as well. It's got a lot of the sort of Hate Bears-y type of cards in it, and it's sort of heading in that direction. This one's got the Flickerwisp main deck.
Oh wow, that card is very good.
This is a collected company deck. This is Abzan collected company. It plays 4 collected company, 3 congregation at dawn, which I have mixed feelings on. These are kind of slotting in here because of the obvious interaction with collected company. And it's kind of like a 1-2 punch when you set up your deck at the end of their turn and then collected company on your turn and you've got your targets. But I don't know, man. Congregation at dawn seems like some Nambo card advantage. You're kind of putting away a card and stacking the top of your deck. You're not drawing into those cards unless you're, you know, going to actually resolve the collected company. But...
I mean, you're still drawing the cards. So, like, sure, you don't draw them with collected company, but, like, you still look at, like, what your opponent's doing. And it's basically, this is trying to be a Birthing Pod deck. It's not trying to be a Hate Bears deck. Like, you're looking at it on the wrong, like, hinge of things.
I'm not saying it is. I'm saying this is making me think that Hate Bears is viable with this sort of build.
Yeah. Like, this is a Birthing Pod deck for sure. Like, this took Congregation at Dawn is basically this deck's Birthing Pod. And then collected company like lets you cheat those creatures into play. Like Congregation of Dawn says, I'm going to draw these really powerful creatures that I need to eventually get to. And then collected company lets you go, I'm going to put them into play at instant speed. You can't counter that. So, I mean, randomly, because of so many creatures with converted mana cost less than 3, you're going to hit 2 things off collected company anyways. But yeah, it's like, especially if you look at the sideboard, this screams this guy played Birthing Pod and now wants to play Birthing Pod again. Like one Aven Mindsetzer, one Blood Baron, one Burrington Fortune, one Core Firewalker, one Eidolon, one Cigarda. He's trying to play like a Birthing Pod deck and use Congregation at Dawn to replace Birthing Pod. I think that's kind of awkward. I would rather this card be Corticalling.
Yeah,
because no, I agree. It mimics Birthing Pod much better, but it doesn't give you like the free roll of setting up a Collected Company that you're going to like. Because a lot of times you're going to end a turn Collected Company or end a turn Congregation, draw like the one card you don't want to like Collected Company into, and then Collected Company into the other two.
Oh, right. So, yeah, so it's three. I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've actually I put together a deck similar to this in Malira. What do you call it? Collected Malira. And what bothered me so much was that the fact that there was like literally no removal main deck aside from like the artifact and enchantment hate in the Kasali Pride Mage. But it's sure. Very like all into the combo strategy, which works because the combo strategy can just ignore a lot of the hate cards on the other side of the board in a lot of cases. Like I beat a deck that resolved an Iona on Cockatrice earlier. It was the blue-white Tron deck. Resolved an Iona and chose white, which is like just about everything in my deck, but I think that was his mistake. He should have said green, probably.
Well, I mean, he has to pick white so it doesn't get passed.
Right.
Like, you show white, he has to pick white.
But it works in some way. And then the sideboard's got the Thought Seizes, it's got the Abrupt Decays, it's got the Path to Exiles, and it's tough to decide what you're going to take out then at that point. But I'm running main deck Spellskite as well, which is pretty sweet in there, and main deck... Aven Mindsetzer is pretty awesome too.
So I want to point out the Singleton Anaphenza Kin Tree Spirit there as a second copy of Malira Silvok Outcast.
Yeah, man.
That also does something crazy anyways. When you sack your Kitchen Fanks, it's a 2-1, it persists. Anaphenza triggers and bolsters it, even if you have Viscera Seer in play, because they're tied for the lowest toughness. So you pick Kitchen Fakes and you bolster it. So that's a second copy of Malira that also doubles as just being better because every time you play a guy, your smallest guy gets bigger. So I would think that the copy of Malira in his deck would get cut for another copy of Anaphenza Kintree Spirit. Because, I mean, unless you're looking for the flexibility against Infect specifically, that like, hey, Infect, your deck's garbage, congratulations. Anaphenza seems like just a strict upgrade.
Well, Daryl, I see what you're saying. That's part of it. But also, too, now if you get Anaphenza and Malira on the board at the same time, you not only are gaining infinite life, but you've got an infinitely large creature, and that's another sort of win condition for you. This one doesn't have the Blard Iris, does it?
No, it does not.
Okay, so right, like all it does right now without the Anaphenza and the Malira is infinite life, and then just like efficient beaters and answer cards. Isn't that right? Yeah,
that's what it does right now.
So I've seen these run Blood Artist, and then that's like a 4-card combo with the Malira, the Kitchen Finks, the Viscera Seer, or Cartel Aristocrat I've seen as well, and then Blood Artist.
Sure.
This way you can just beat in.
That's fair. One thing to note, though, like the Abrupt Decay path, like what are you cutting? There are matchups where like certain cards are really bad. Like Flicker Wisp is a really powerful card, but sometimes it's like too slow because you have to another guy. Sometimes your Artifact Enchantment Hate's bad. Sometimes like that Orzhov Pontiff is horrifyingly terrible. Or Sin Collector's not great. So like there are like some very easy cuts as far as like things you can cut out. You can always shave a Congregation or a Collecting Company if you have to and become just more of a mid-range deck. So I mean it's not terrifyingly difficult to alter by any means as far as the sideboard goes.
Yeah, I mean, this strategy is picking up some steam. I think it's going to be a thing in the future. I don't know if it's going to be Tier 1 or what, but I think that Collected Company is an insanely powerful card in Modern, and the fact that it's instant speed just seems bonkers and like can totally be abused. Maybe this is not the combo to do it with, but I think you know it's worth being aware of and worth being ready for when you're playing against a green-white deck that's got a lot of mana dorks and dumb two-drop creatures.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Congregation at Dawn is a spec that lots of people are going on, and right now it's up to about $3 from, like, I don't know, 65 cents a couple weeks ago. I really don't know about this one. I mean, I think it's fair to spec on. I think people are going to buy it, but, man, I, in the long run, I don't see this being a part of the deck. I think I'd rather it just be more creatures, like three more targets for your Collected Company.
I would just rather it be Corticalling.
Right.
And here's my argument, though. Congregation of Dawn costs 3, so you set up your 2 missing parts of your infinite combo, and then Collected Company is 4 to get them into play. I mean, what's the other combo that goes 3 and then 4 at instant speed?
Splinter Twin?
Twin, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. But that deck plays counter spells to protect the combo and stuff. This is pretty vulnerable. If you Congregation at Dawn and then your Collected Company gets countered, then you're going to draw into those cards in the next two turns, give them plenty of time to set up for answers. I don't know.
Yeah, that we don't exactly present something like Mother of Runes to keep them from killing our guys. We are just like, well, here it is. Do you have it? Nope. All right, we win.
Well, you've got Spellskite.
Yeah, I mean, you have one.
All right, we better move on from this one. There's one more modern deck I want to look at before we go on, and we can do this quick. It's a Jund Midrange deck in 7th place. This is Rudy Briskza. Maybe that's not how you say that, but we'll call him Rudy Briskza for today. There are two Hunt Masters main deck, which I think are pretty fun in modern, but very, very killable, which is my only concern with those guys. There is one Thundermaw Hellkite, two Olivia, pretty awesome, three Lilianas, Abrupt Decay. It's got one Kolaghan's Command in here, which I was kind of surprised to see, and also one on the board. And then your typical Thoughtseize, Maelstrom Pulse package, Inquisition, Terminates. What do you guys think of this one?
It just looks like a good Jund deck.
Yeah, so Kolaghan's Command is actually more powerful than you think it is. I've actually been thinking about playing it in a deck with exactly three creatures, and they're all Sacrifice to Rage. So against Affinity, it's one of the most flexible cards you're ever going to get to play. You're going to get Shock plus Shatter for three mana, which you're completely willing to pay for. Against decks that, like, when you get to the top deck war, you're going to get Rebuy a Guy plus discard your card during your draw step. And, like, rebuy your guy, shock your other guy is always reasonable. And then, like, the creatures you have to rebuy are just insanely powerful. You have Tassigar, you have Olivia, you have Thundermaw Hellkite. Tarmogoyf is always just a big doofus. Huntmaster of the Fells. Like, I think Kolaghan's Command definitely shines when the game goes much later, because you're going to have one of these really powerful creatures that your opponent's probably not going to be able to interact with because they're top deck. And so that's why you'll see, like, in games that'll go long, you'll see both of the Kolaghan's Commands, and you'll just... And then they also combo with the Fulminator Mage on the sideboard. Fulminator Rage you, Kolaghan's Command, rebuy my Fulminator Rage you. So you can kind of like get the little loop going there as well. I think the only thing for as far as like Jund decks that I really like that this one missed out on, and it could just be because the mana is so tight, I like a Akessic Wolfrun in these decks just because here's a guy, I have Akessic Wolfrun, you have to kill it.
And yeah, I like that too. That is a fun win condition that's hard to interact with. It turns all your crappy top deck mana dorks into threats.
Yeah, I mean, there are no mana dorks here, but like a lot of times, especially with cards like Scavengers and Tarmogoyf, if your opponent gums up the ground, like you have a Thundermaw Hellkite and two Olivias to go over them, but just like I have a 5/6 Tarmogoyf, attack, pay red, green, and tap Wolfrun, it has trample. Like you don't have to put mana into it, so you can like give your Tarmogoyf trample and then play another spell. And not care. Like, it still gives trample, even if you give it +0/+0. So, like, giving your Tarmogoyf trample is not unreasonable.
Alright. Let's go to Legacy real quick. This should be nice and short, because there are only two decks posted at this point. This is the 6th that we're recording, so hopefully the rest of them will be up. In first, there was a Jeskai Stoneblade deck, David Melendez. And, as far as I know, this is, like, to be expected here. I don't see anything out of the ordinary, but I'm not a Legacy player, as I have mentioned time and time again.
He's a little heavy on main deck counterspell, but other than that, I don't see anything too unusual.
Do you mean literally counterspell? There are two of those.
Literally two counterspells.
That's a lot of counterspells, yeah.
Okay. That's more than one. 4 Terminus main deck. And 3 Vendilion Cleek. Is that typical? 3 Cleek?
This seems more like a
Miracles deck.
A hybrid. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think this is kind of just misnamed. Yeah, this is just Miracles with, you know, usually they play Stoneforge sometimes. And
oh, there's just no counterbalances.
Yeah.
It's not like a tempo Stoneblade deck. It's just like a controlling Stoneblade deck. Okay. I was like, what did you say Terminus for? Like, that deck doesn't play Terminus. Like, that makes no sense whatsoever. Yeah. So it looks like it's just a little bit of red, a touch of red on the sideboard, a Pyroclasm, and 3 Red Blasts. So it looks like it's just like blue-white Stoneblade splashing. Oh, there's Bolts. Okay, there's Bolts. Never mind. I missed the Bolts in the main board. So
they just call this Jeskai Control?
Yeah, like it's literally just a control deck. It's not like it plays out like Stone Blade because it's like Jace, Stoneforge, Click. It's like the very first iterations of Stone Blade before they started printing things like True Name Nemesis and all those crazy Deathrite Shaman, all that stuff. Like when Stoneforge Mystic like first hit the scene in Legacy and then like Snapcaster came out, this is kind of what your Stone Blade deck would look like, except for Terminus. It's just sort of like, hi, I'm Terminus, and I'm not the right deck, but I'm good anyways, so, like, play me.
You know what this deck needs? Four Tybalt.
No.
All right. What does Tybalt do? Whatever that first ability is? Oh, man, that'd be good in here. What is
irrelevant. Right. Fired.
Let's move on.
Fired. You're fired.
All right, then the other half of the postings for the Legacy Open is the 13th place deck. I'm not sure how this one is there. Maybe it got deck teched. I was not watching coverage. Dark Maverick, and it actually looks pretty sweet. It is a junk Maverick deck. And if there were not four Wastelands, a Bayou, three Savannas, and one Scrubland in here, I might consider trying to put this one together. But there are.
I mean, you just have
and
to...
And Caracas.
You just have to bite the bullet, man. You want to play Legacy,
I did that once before. And
put your teeth on the bullet. Clench your jaw and accept it. Like,
well, this looks like my solid deck is what I'm saying, and it's four Knight of the Reliquary in here. Pretty awesome. How is this different than the typical junk deck? Can a Legacy informed person please explain?
Well, a lot of the times you'll see just like green white Maverick. So like if he's playing junk Maverick, he's splashing, and specifically splashing for Abrupt Decay because like Maverick struggles against counterbalance. If they can't get Chrysalid Bridemage online, they're just going to fold to like getting all their 2 and 3 mana guys countered. Plus, you're just getting like Grim Lavamancer and Deathrite Shaman. I mean, I have lots of opinions, but all it...
They upgrade. The Dark Maverick upgrades Noble Hierarch to Deathrite Shaman.
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
Also worth noting, like, things that are out of the ordinary that you wouldn't normally see in most decks in Legacy. There's Armageddon in the sideboard of this deck. He really doesn't like Miracles. He just wants to kill everyone's lands and have a Knight of the Reliquary in play and be like, oh yeah? How about a 12-12?
Ooh, that's pretty fun, isn't it?
Yeah. Or I think if you're going to be on the Armageddon strategy, you want to have a Singleton Terrivore to Green Sun Zenith 4. Because it counts both graveyards and has trample, which is actually the part that matters. Like, Knight of the Reliquary is 12-12 and you put them in the Abyss. How about a 12-12 that puts them in the Abyss and tramples over? So...
Has Sylvan Safekeeper been a sideboard staple in Knight of the Reliquary decks for some time, or is that new?
I've seen him ticking up. There's a Dark Maverick Vile version. It just plays Aether Vile.
Yeah.
And then you need your lands less, so then that Sylvan Safekeeper can activate more often.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
It's also just a thing that you can play because you have four green Sylvan. Like... any green creature that you can sneak into your deck as a one-up over your opponent, whether it be a Siege Rhino or Titania, Protector of Argoth, which I've seen in some lists, Sylvan Safekeeper on the small side. Like, whatever guy you can sneak in there that'll just give your opponent a punch that they won't be expecting is just a good card to have, because you have four greens, so you essentially have five copies.
Okay. Cool. All right. And then also this weekend was the Modern States, the TCG Player Modern States. I don't know. Did you guys have a chance to play in that at all? I mean,
I didn't have a chance to travel, unfortunately.
I'm doing the Star City States next weekend.
Okay. Oh, yeah. So there's...
Yeah, so am I.
All right. Well, good luck with that. I will not have a chance to play next week. And I did have a chance to play this last weekend. And I top eighted with... I was playing five color good stuff is what it's called, but I have it listed here
congrats.
As Modern Tribal Zoo, and I'll post the deck list in the show notes. But I wanted to talk about our top eight this was at Pink Bunny Games in Milwaukee. It was a pretty interesting top eight. There's some cool decks in there, and I think Infect ended up taking down the whole thing. There was a guy playing a Jeskai deck that ran Seeker of the Ways, and what is the red mana? One and a red, 1/2, whenever you play an instant or sorcery, it gets +3/+0.
You mean 2-mana 1/2? It's Kiln Fiends.
Kiln Fiend, yep. He had Kiln Fiends and Seeker of the Ways, which seems crazy. This guy was undefeated, though, in the before the top eight, and actually lost in the first round. I was kind of pulling for him.
Oh, he's playing the lunch break deck is what people call it.
Is that
it's
right?
Like Monastery Swift Spear. Some versions went Seeker of the Way.
Yep.
A lot of versions went green because of like Rancor. But it's just like, I'm going to play these dudes that have prowess or get bigger when you play Instant Sorcery and try and kill you on like turn three with like Assault Strobe. Like Kiln Fiend, pump spell, bolt you, Assault Strobe, attack for 20.
Played a lot of Phyrexian cards, get Taxing Probe and the like. When I played him, I had no idea what I was up against. And he killed me with the Teamer Battle Rage one game, and I was like totally not expecting it. But I felt like I had like a good matchup against him. And, you know, like I'm holding the Abrupt Decays and things. And he just blew me out on turn three, both games. So I was like, holy cow.
Like, two things about that sort of deck.
Yeah.
You have to be aware that Apostle's Blessing is a magic card that will blow you out of the water 100 times. Like, you'll Abrupt Decay something, and they'll go, oh, yeah, I'll pay two life. It's pro black. And you'll look at your hand, and you'll go, yeah, I don't have anything else. And you'll have to pick up your cards because you're probably dead at that point. And they, like, Teamer Battle Rage it, and it's like a 10-power double striker with Trample. That deck is something scary when it fires, but it's pretty inconsistent.
Yeah. All right. Let's see here. So I've got my deck list in the show notes. I'm going to go through it real quick and just kind of explain what I was running it so you understand my my experiences here, because I ended up going down to Scape Shift. I somehow can never play against that deck. And every time I lose it, I feel like, how does this deck ever lose? And I mean, I understand that it's kind of a slow combo to set up, but I don't know. It should have been a good matchup for me, and I just played poorly. It was the end of the day, and I was fried. But I was running 21 lands. 12 of them were fetches, and then the rest of them were shocks, aside from a forest and a plains. And my mana situation was never an issue, even though I was running five colors. I had two birds, two Noble Hierarch, which I think was a little light on the mana darts from what people are usually doing. The Nikados.
What's the reason for that split, Corey?
It was mostly because I only had two Noble Hierarchs, and I wanted to run four of them. But it ended up being good with the birds because I was like, I really was spread among all five colors pretty well. And I'm kind of liking that. I think I'm going to stick with that regardless of what I actually have at my disposal.
Yeah, I think that's also fine because, like, if you look at his deck list, like, he's going to go through it. There's four Siege Rhinos. There's a Tassiger. There's four Lightning Bolts. There's Abrupt Decay. There's Pyroclasm on the sideboard. There's a lot of cards that this deck would struggle to cast with Noble Hierarch because it's missing one of those two off colors, red or black. So birds being able to make, even though you get an Exalted trigger, birds being able to make that other color is really big.
Okay. So you got 21 lands, four mana dorks. What's the rest?
Pretty much jam packed with creatures and spells in there. I mean, I wanted to stay light on the mana dark so I could run. I've got the Voices in there, two Voice of Resurgence, two Snapcasters were actually really awesome because of the fact that Tribal Flames was two mana for five damage, and Snapcaster plus Tribal Mage was, or Tribal Flames was four mana for five more damage. Three Lingering Souls, two Abrupt Decay, four Lightning Bolt, three Path, all of the things that Daryl mentioned, and I don't know, did you say?
Yeah, I think we skipped over. Four Wild Nikotle, three Geist, the same track. I skipped over those because those were cards that Noble Hierarch cast very easily.
The deck was incredibly consistent. I mean, it's kind of like base Bant, if anything, and then goes into black for the Siege Rhino and the Tassiger on the top end. I didn't end up casting the Tassiger once all day, and it was probably because I sided it out a lot. The Siege Rhinos and Tassigers came out against a lot of the control decks I was playing that were running Mana Leak's main deck, and I just went for the low-cost creatures and like the Splinter Twin answers. But mostly I want to just talk about this sideboard because that was the thing that was the shining star of the day. And my favorite card of all, and I hope that this kind of catches on, is the Crackling Doom, which I understand why it's not because the cost is so restrictive. There aren't a whole lot of decks running red, white, and black right now. But Crackling Doom does not target an opponent. It asks them to sacrifice the largest creature in terms of power. And then it deals two damage to them. So it's just about everything you want. And the biggest reason it was effective for me was because it got past the Spellskites. So when I'm siding the Crackling Dooms and they're siding the Spellskites, they've seen Paths, they've seen Lightning Bolts in my main deck and Abrupt Decays. All of those things can be redirected by the Spellskite. But Crackling Doom hits their Splinter Twin combo when it's going off, or hits their Thrun, or hits their, you know, big threats, and was just like a total all-star all day.
Yeah, that's
so
a card.
Make this work. Their Spellskite has to be the only creature they have.
No, if they have Spellskite and a Deceiver Exarch, and they go, all right, Splinter Twin, you Crackling Doom, And they have to pick a creature with the highest power, which is the Seaver Exarch, and sacrifice it.
Okay, so you don't actually want to hit the spell sky. You want to
no, like the spell sky's the idiot you don't care about. You're like, you're in the way. I want to path that guy, but you eat my path. Yeah, like that's one of the cards that I wanted to play that five color control deck for. Like a lot of it looks like these like really powerful draw spells were great, but like Crackling Doom is just a very powerful magic card. You kill like. Like for your deck, I bet Tarmogoyf is a big problem. Just like get your Tarmogoyf out of the way, attack you with a Geist, and like in a while, the Connell will take 9, and your opponent's all of a sudden at like 6 life, and they're like, "Well, that didn't work out the way I expected it to."
Yeah. Tarmogoyf was a little bit of an issue. And one of the times I actually encountered Tarmogoyf, and I can't believe this has never happened to me before. I should have known this. He played Goyf on turn 2 as a 2/3, and he knew I had a Lightning Bolt in hand.
You got blown out by the bolt trick, didn't you?
Yes, it's so unintuitive, man. But let me explain what this is real quick in case you haven't heard of this before, because I hope that no one else has to make this mistake. It was like sorcery and land in the graveyard, making Tarmogoyf a 2/3. I've got a red mana untapped. He knows I has a bolt. I thought he was just trying to draw it out of me, and it was a very odd play, and I sat there looking at it for a second, like, why should I not bolt this creature? Oh, obviously because when I play the bolt on it, it hits the yard and the creature becomes a 3/4. For some reason, I've never had that happen to me before, and so, I guess it's just because it's so situational, there's got to be no instant to begin with, but my God. Daryl, can you explain that one?
Yeah, I've got a lot of judge background here. So what happens is you cast... So you'll cast a spell, you'll go through all those annoying steps where, like, cast, target, pay, whatever. So you'll cast Lightning Bolt, targeting Tarmogoyf. The Lightning Bolt will resolve and go to the graveyard and deal the 3 damage it's supposed to. And then state-based actions only check after a spell's resolution. So if state-based actions were to check while you're dealing 3 damage to Tarmogoyf before Lightning Bolt makes it to the graveyard, the Lightning Bolt will kill the Tarmogoyf. But the spell has to finish resolving, the stack has to be either empty or there has to be a priority check, which would be like if there are multiple spells in the stack, the bolt would resolve and then there's like more spells, it checks for state-based actions. And the Tarmogoyf goes, oh look, there's an instant, I'm a 3/4. And the Lightning Bolt goes, well, I only did 3 damage, so you get to live, good job. Yeah, so that's really a really awkward rules interaction.
Yeah.
And if you've never played against Tarmogoyf ever... You're going to lose to it the first time, and then you're never going to lose to it again until you stop playing like damage-based removal. Like when you used to play Lightning Bolt against Tarmogoyf, you remember this. And then you go to like playing just Path, and then you go back to playing like Lightning Bolt, you'll forget it, and you'll mess it up again, and then you won't mess it up anymore. It happens like – unless you just have a very good memory about this, every time you play like damage-based removal against Tarmogoyf.
Well, magic is hard. But Tarmogoyf is not a terribly awful card for me. I've got Paths in the main deck. I've got Abrupt Decay in the main deck. And Tribal Flames is like consistently 5 damage by turn 3, whereas Tarmogoyf is usually hanging out around the 4/5 region, creature, sorcery, instant land.
Yeah, but if you're Tribal Flames against Tarmogoyf, you're not winning. Like, that's the last thing you want to do, really.
Well, Daryl, I did. I won that game. That was a Tarma Twin matchup, and I ended up going on from there. But that said... I did lose to Scapeshift, and it was a sad day, and I was gone after that. So I think I ended up 3rd/4th place, got my playmat. Smells kind of funny. They printed it weird this year, and I've got some kind of, like, urine aroma to them right now. So I've got to air it out outside, but hopefully we'll get on from that, and I'll be able to rock that in the future.
You didn't happen to win an extra large T-shirt from Pink Bunny at all, did you?
No, but I've got one. You need one? It's a large. I've never worn it.
Yeah, sometimes they like to give those out as prizes.
Oh, yeah. No, that was from my – I won the free Magic for a year, 2014. So I've got that. Unfortunately, I've never worn it, but it's not because I don't like Pink Bunny, so don't take it personally. All right. And then – oh, yeah, from that, I just wanted to add Spellskite is the ultimate sideboard card in Modern. I can't even believe how versatile that card is. It's insane. I don't know if you guys run these in your sideboards. Daryl, I don't think you do, but it's because you play the Glittering Wish package.
Yeah.
Holy cow, man. It does everything you want. And when you've got blue in your deck, it's even better.
Yeah, it's very good.
So, all right. I'm going to change some things in my sideboard. I'll post an updated list, but I probably will get rid of the Maelstrom Pulse. I probably will get rid of the Sigarda. And let's see here. I think there's a better alternative to Rock's War Monk, but I'm thinking that... I need a better answer against Burn than the way I'm running it right now. So stay tuned for that. It'll be on the show notes in the future. All right.
Before we move on from tournaments and cards here, the investigative journalism has come back in. Oh, yeah. Circle Protection Red in 8th and 9th edition. I think both of them are crappy white borders, though, so don't play it, please.
Don't keep it that long.
I had it for a while, but we had good discussion going, so I just back pocketed it and moved on.
All right, really quick news update. It is the PPTQ format change. I'm going to pass this one over to you two, and I'm going to check out for a second here. Go ahead.
Okay. Daryl, you read it, so...
Yeah, I read it, and then we can kind of kick it around, and I'll kind of kick it off. So basically what happened is last season, the PPTQs were basically whatever format the store wanted to run them in would qualify you for an RPTQ or whatever, a PTQ proper as we see them. And then you would, like, win a PTQ and go play and play in the Pro Tour. So the problem with that was is that you would have people winning standard PTQs to prepare for modern Pro Tours. You'd have people winning modern Pro TQs to play in standard Pro Tours. Or I don't know if – I think they got rid of the block Pro Tour, thank God. But, like, they were playing different formats than the PTQs and the Pro Tours that they were qualifying for. And so Wizards basically said, all right, we've listened to the people. We've listened to the store owners. We're done with this. This is not going to happen anymore. So starting on June 6th and moving forward for the next season – they're going to be tying the PPTQs and the RPTQs to the Pro Tour you're qualifying for. So this next season, it'll be just Modern, but they also leave you the option if you don't want to have Modern, you can do Sealed Deck. So it's either the format you're qualifying for, Modern, which makes sense. You're going to need these cards to go play at the Pro Tour anyway, so you might as well play with them to get there. Or Sealed Deck, because, you know, nothing wrong with giving everybody six packs and battling to see who can get there. So those two, that's the really big change, honestly. It makes sense. Like, keeping Sealed in there doesn't really make sense to me, because if your store doesn't have a big enough community to get you qualified for the type of Pro Tour you're playing in, you shouldn't have a Pro Tour qualifier. You shouldn't have a PPTQ. Just my personal opinion. If you can't drum up enough people from the surrounding community to do it, then I'm not a huge fan. But
the king of 10 local players can't make it to the Pro Tour?
I mean, the king of 10 local players can make it to the PTQ. And then, I mean, if he gets his head kicked in, he gets his head kicked in. But, like, I defer to you guys. What do you guys think about the change itself, kind of hearing that, you know, it's – they're trying to streamline things and make them make sense.
I like it. I'm looking forward to the PTQ for 250-card Highlander Scribble Ante.
Not going to happen.
They announced that, Daryl. Okay, I'm lying. Go on. Sorry, Brandon.
Thank you.
I think that beforehand, these events were a good way for a store to hold something that was a little more than an FNM if they had local players that only play standard. And then, you know, if there's the modern Pro Tour, well, those local standard players don't want to play modern, so that means the store can't have a more advanced tournament. But if that's the case at a local store, well, like Daryl said, they probably don't have the kind of players it's going to take to play in the Pro Tour. So I understand the streamlined process. And, you know, for me, I'm more excited about playing in modern PPTQs over standard PPTQs any day. So personally, this makes me happy.
All right, the next comment on here I did not put on the show notes. Brandon, is that you?
Oh, yeah, this is breaking news. Yeah. So Xu Ming, our chief financial officer, is MIA this week, off fighting those dragons of Tarkir. So do you guys are familiar with Puka Trade, right?
Yes.
Okay, so do you guys know what Puka Trade is starting to do on Kickstarter right now?
I do not.
Yeah, they're trying to get MTGO running on there. Well,
yeah, they have a campaign, and if I think it's already over, and I haven't checked to see if they made their funding yet, but what they're trying to do is make it so you can convert your paper collection to an online collection on Modo, or you could take your online Modo collection and transfer it over to a paper collection. And so
I have a quick question before you continue on. Is that value for value or card for card?
That's a very good question. I don't know how you would balance that, because
I don't think it can be card for card, because if you look at it, like, I have Miracles deck in Modo, it costs $500. I would like it in real life. It costs like $3,000.
I think it's got to be.
There's a disparity there. I think it has to be, but I just for the listeners, you know, let's kind of clarify what could be going on there.
Okay. By the way, that is 100% funded. In fact, it's 144% funded, $11,495 at this point. So, go on.
Wow. All right. Sorry. Great. So, so I've been psyched up. I've been inputting my cards in Puka. And, you know, last week, John Galley had called that spike on Surak. You know, Surak jumped from 50 cents to, you know, about $5. Well, tied to Dragons of Tarkir, I found out that our good buddy Dragon Speaker Shaman from Scourge jumped from about $1 to $5 with the release of Dragons of Tarkir.
Literal no reason for this card to go up $4. Literal no reason. Get this out of here.
The reason is people want to build dragons because it's topical. And it's the same reason that Sign of the Ur-Dragon is now, what, $17, $15 on TCG Player? And so all dragon-related cards right now are going up. I assume that the black-red Return of Dragon from your graveyard to play is up there, too.
Bladewing there isn't, yeah.
Bladewing, yeah, let's check that guy out.
Of course, yeah. I didn't notice this in the show notes before, I'll be honest. And then I clicked on it, and I'm like, I don't ever remember this card being 450. Like, even during Scourge Block, when the standard, like, the block-constructed deck was like, Killmouth Dragon and Dragon Speaker Shaman and like all these powerful dragons to put this like 5/5 flyer in a play that said tap deal damage equal to the number of +1/+1 counters on it, and every dragon you revealed when it came into play gave it +3/+1/+1 counters. So you'd literally just reveal three dragons, put 9 counters on it, and be like, all right, 9 you or 9 your guy, but probably you just by tapping.
Wait, are we talking about the same card here?
Killmouth Dragon, yeah.
Oh yeah, okay, got it.
Yeah, Killmouth Dragon, I think it was. And it's just like, this card wasn't $5 then. But they print some, like, reasonable dragons, and it's $5 now? Like, okay.
This is just another data point for Magic Finance 101, guys. You just gotta pay attention to those set names
So related to that, like, I'm actually surprised the Bladewing the Risen is only about $1.50. It's been printed like 3 times. I don't think it's going to go up if it hasn't already. Dragon Tyrant's the same way, about $2.50. This fits right into a Sign of the Ur-Dragon deck, as Brandon used to do that all the time in instant speed, turn into Dragon Tyrant, double strike for commander damage. That card got thrown out a window once when we were playing EDH, I remember. But related to that, the whole hype of, like, okay, this set's based around dragons. People want to build dragons in casual formats in an EDH. Battle for Zendikar is coming out, and I just got done listening to a Brainstorm Brewery where they pointed out that Zendikar last time had a vampire theme. And so I do expect that it's going to happen again in the Return to Zendikar. Or what am I saying here? The original Zendikar had a vampire theme. Battle for Zendikar will, too. So it might be a good idea to start specking on some of the vampire cards, like Vampire Nocturnus. Maybe even Calastria Highborn or whatever the heck that card's called.
So my question is, did Karthus Tyrant of Jund go up? Because, like, Karthus is in the same realm as, like, Dragon sure Speaker Shaman and Scion. That, like, this card's really stupid. It came into play. I get all the dragons. You're all dead. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's a really good meta call for everyone playing the dragon decks. Just play your
cards
and take it. It's $16 at the lowest, and that's a heavily played one, so it did, in fact, go up. This card is not worth $16. What about Hellkite Overlord?
Like, this is absurd. Can we please walk away from the way overpriced Dragon Speaker Shaman?
This is great, though. Take advantage of it. Wow. You've got these cards sitting around. Put them on Puka. Yeah. Get rid of them now. I literally found 3 Dragon Speaker Shamans in my basement at my dad's house like 2 days ago. I pulled them out of a box. It was like, there's $20. So those are going right on Puka trade.
Perfect. All right. You found the money.
Yep, I did. All right. Then we are going on here. Discussion. All right, there's an article posted on the Wizards Mothership site that I thought was pretty interesting. It's called The Pillar That Never Was, and this came out on April 3rd. It's still April, I guess. And it's basically a storyline about how there's like a chain reaction that caused Siege Rhino and Anafenza to be different costs than they were originally being tested as. And there's a card called First Response in M15. It's a 4 mana. It's white and 3. For an enchantment that says at the beginning of your upkeep, or at the beginning of each upkeep, excuse me, if you lost life last turn, put a 1/1 white soldier token on the battlefield. Now, this is the actual printing of this card, but originally this was a 2-mana card that said exactly the same thing, except for at the beginning of each end step, if you lost life this turn, put a 1/1 soldier on the battlefield, which seems like a pretty blatantly powerful card, and they found that when they were testing it out, especially with Mana Confluence floating around. So, they made the card 3-mana, and it solved the problem for a little bit.
Yeah, I was saying, actually, this kind of change was a little weird. They, like, couldn't cast your wedge spells. Like, it was before that that things got changed. So, they moved it to 3-mana.
Okay.
And then they were, like, playing, because they had check lands in the 4-mana originally. Like, they were going to print
that. That was the M15 land of choice for a while.
Yeah, Glacial Fortress et al., Drowned Catacomb. And they found that you just couldn't, like, between the allied colored fetch lands and the tap lands, the tri lands that were coming in, and, like, Mana Confluence and Temples, your check lands never came into play untapped. So they cut the check lands and they put pain lands in, the Caves of Koilos, Battlefield Forge, that cycle of land. And so when they put that cycle of land into, so that you could cast cards like Mantis Rider on turn 3, they realized that, holy crap, First Response is even better than it already was.
Right, and I think this card is just, like, would be insane in, like, a Jeskai Tokens deck right now. As it's now up to 4-mana, it's not so much the case, but there are a couple of brews on this article that are talking white-black tokens that seem kind of interesting. There's a Jerry Thompson one and an Adam Prosak one. And so check those out if you're interested. But basically what this caused was... When the card was 3-mana and still powerful, they wanted to print some beaters that could deal with it. And Siege Rhino was originally a 3-cost card. It was white, black, and green for a 3/4. Enters the battlefield. Each opponent loses 2 life, and you gain 2 life. If a spell or ability an opponent controls causes you to discard Siege Rhino, put it on the battlefield instead of putting it into your graveyard. And that was basically the balance for Liliana of the Veil that was originally in M15. And so in order to combat the tokens that were overwhelming the, potential format that they're creating, they needed to give this guy trample. He turned into what he is today. He's a 4/5 trampler for 4. And, at the time they already had Anafenza of the Foremost as a 4-mana, Abzan card. And then they said, okay, we can't have 2. Abzan became a 3-mana card, but Abzan's original plan was to be...
Anafenza?
Oh, yep. Anafenza. I'm sorry. Yep. Anafenza's original plan was to be a 1 white, black, and green 4/6 human soldier. When it attacks, put 2 +1/+1 counters on another target creature you control. If a creature an opponent controls would die, exile it instead. So similar to the one that we've got today, but definitely like kind of the like more powerful EDH version of it. And so I don't know what you guys think, but I wanted to maybe have a quick discussion on how, if you think this Siege Rhino would be as dominant and show up in the same way that it does today if it was still a white, black, green 3/4 for 2 life and had the Dodeca probability.
So I will say that Siege Rhino actually went through 3 iterations.
Oh,
I think its first iteration is fine. It's a sideboard card. It's a relatively efficient beater. It would still see play in Modern because it's, a 4 toughness creature. Like, 4 toughness is still enough to beat a Lightning Bolt. Flame Slash is a thing. Roast is a thing. But, like, it would still see play in Modern. But the second iteration of Siege Rhino, before it became a 4/5, would have definitely seen play in Modern and Legacy because it got the text could not be countered on it. Okay. So it was a 3/4 for white, black, green. When it enters the battlefield, you lose 2 life, or you gain 2 life, they lose 2 life. Uncounterable. That would have seen a ton of play.
Like, yeah, that's
an
pretty
absolute insane amount of play. So the fact that they knocked that off of there and made it a 4/5 trampler made it go from like absolutely unreasonable to oppressive. So it went from Dodecapod to uncounterable to like what it is now. And so I think the middle one would have been the most atrocious to deal with version of Siege Rhino.
Yeah, like a way better highway robber. Just the 2 life. Not to mention that we talked a lot about Collected Company earlier. This would slot into a Collected Company deck in the current standard pretty well, as it would be a 3-cost card that saps for a 4-point life swing. I think that would be pretty explosive.
That's a good mention because they hadn't caught up with Collected Company before they made these changes.
Yeah.
So, wow, that's there's a lot of ripples here that would have changed a lot of things.
So it's kind of funny to see how the first response enchantment that creates the tokens caused all these changes. And obviously the Anafenza would still be a good card at 4 mana, but I'm glad we got the 3 mana version of it. I like it much better. All right. Cool. Brandon, any thoughts on that?
I like 3 mana siege rhinos, but
you like the 3 mana uncounterable siege rhino. You're a big fan of this.
Well, you know, I don't like blue in Legacy very much, so yeah, it would have slotted perfect into all my less powerful Legacy decks.
Okay, cool. All right. So, in the interest of time, we always seem to be running low on time here. We're gonna skip our next discussion question. We'll save that for next week. So. Next up, Brandon's got a Juicy Deck Tech.
Juicy Deck Tech.
I think we need music for this.
We need some like workout music, like they're in the gym and people are like exhaling, you know? That sweat's just dripping down everybody's like arms and stuff, because this deck is just so juicy. So let's jump over to this. This is a here we go. This is a Smallpox Loam deck in Modern. And it took second at a PPTQ in Milwaukee on the 14th of last month. And so this is a deck I'm really interested in, because I really like the grindy decks in both Modern and Legacy. And we have Star City Games version of Modern States coming up this weekend. And so I'm trying to play something very similar to this. And I think it's pretty well positioned in the metagame right now. If there's a lot of Tron and a lot of Splinter Twin running around. So here's the list that took second in Milwaukee. It has 23 lands. I'm not going to go over all of them, but there's a good amount of fetches. Looks like this one's running about 8 of them. It's 4 colors, so everything but blue. Strong base in black. It has 2 Tectonic Edges and that's it. Sometimes they run a Ghost Quarter. This guy has 2 Ghost Quarters, so those are his utility lands. Everything else adds color or is a fetch land. For creatures, so this is like a graveyard-based recursion strategy. It's kind of meant to grind your opponent down and get value on Life from Loam. So its creatures are 4 Bloodghast.
Ooh, that's your favorite vengeful black creature, isn't it, Brandon?
My new favorite black creature is actually Vengeful Pharaoh, which right. I didn't even know existed.
Wait, I think I got this one. I'm going to try and remember this right off the top of my head before you even look at it. 2 black for a 5/4 death touch.
Yeah, so far, so good.
All right. And if it's in your graveyard and your opponent deals damage to you, you may destroy the creature that dealt damage to you and put Vengeful Pharaoh on top of your deck.
Oh, so close, Daryl.
Is it a Planeswalker, too?
It's a tribal Planeswalker.
No, I mean, like, is it a Planeswalker or a creature?
A creature dealt combat damage to you or a Planeswalker you control.
Yeah.
Eventual Pharaoh is in your graveyard. Destroy target attacking creature. Not just that Sorry. One, but any target.
Oh, what a sweet card.
Yeah.
All right. I played this in a control deck. I remember playing this guy as like a one-up finisher. Attack with you with my 5/4. Oh, you killed it. Oh, you attacked me. Kill your guy. Sweet. That was awesome.
Yeah, that was definitely
a thing that happened.
So it plays one of those. It plays 1 Squee, Goblin Nabob. That's the guy who brings himself back every turn. And then 1 Golgari Brownscale, which is a dredge creature. And whenever you dredge him, or actually it's not whenever you dredge, whenever he is put into your hand from your graveyard, you gain 2 life. So you can dredge him, and that's about the only way to get him back in this deck. But sometimes you can get him back other ways. So those are the 7 creatures. And then the 26 instants and sorceries has 4 Smallpox, 4 Lingering Souls, 4 Life from the Loam, 4 Faithless Suiting, my favorite non-brainstorm, 2 Abrupt Decay, 2 Go for the Throw It, 2 Dark Blast, 1 Murderous Cut, 1 Flame Jab, 1 Terminate, 1 Raven's Crime, and finally, the 4 other spells are 4 Zombie Infestation. And that's a 2 mana black enchantment. You get to discard 2 cards at instant speed. to put in a 2/2 black zombie creature token into play.
I mean, they just have a younger guy brown scales back in their graveyard to gain some life.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you can pitch your Vengeful Pharaoh at instant speed after they've attacked you, and they don't know that your Pharaoh's in your graveyard, and then they can kill their best dude. Other sweet synergies is like, you know, Faithless Loot, get away your blood gas, bring him back with a land drop.
So this is really spicy. I'm a huge fan of...
Yeah, this is what I'm saying. We need that gym music where everybody's just sweating that juice.
All right, so there's one card when I look at this deck. Yeah, there's one card that I look at this deck and I just wonder why is it missing, and that's Liliana the Forest.
Bear. Why Forest? Is that what you were thinking, Daryl?
No, I was thinking why no Liliana?
Oh, why no Liliana? Yeah, that seems like a good inclusion, right? Maybe better than one of those zombie infestations or two.
Well, actually, I've been playing this deck lately, and this deck is actually really tough to pilot because. Of all those one-ofs, and there's just so many different things you want to do every turn, but usually you only have about 3, sometimes 4 mana tops each turn. And okay, so
that explains.
The Liliana. Yeah. Yeah, the Liliana is 3 mana.
Yeah. So, like, the next question I was going to ask is, like, a question that I really like, as far as a card I really like in these decks, which is Worm Harvest, which is 2 and 3 black green hybrids.
Oh, yeah.
Make a 1/1 for each. Make a 1/1 worm for each land you have in your graveyard with retrace. So you discard a land, cast, pay the 5 mana, and you cast Worm Harvest. So that was another one. Like, I was wondering, like, that seems like a really good card for this deck, is to just, like, discard my land. There's, like, 9 lands in my graveyard. Make 9 1/1s. Go. Like,
yeah, that seems good. But, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Tybalt.
Tybalt.
Just leave. Tybalt. Leave the podcast, please.
You draw a card. You could discard a card at random. And you might discard one of your dredge cards. You might discard a Vengeful Pharaoh.
Please just leave the podcast.
All right, I'm going to China.
You're fired. That's the worst idea ever.
Okay, right. But Daryl, you're absolutely right. Worm Harvest. So I'm trying to build this deck up for this coming weekend, and I'm definitely squeezing a Worm Harvest in there.
Yeah, I just don't know. I felt like in like a format as grindy as Modern, where like if you're not playing against the combo decks that are like Splinter Twin and Scapeshift, you're just kind of like in a point of the elbow grind fest against like Abzan, and like they Lingering Souls and make 4/1/1s. You're like, fine, all right. Worm Harvest, make 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 8 1/1s. How's that sound? And they're like, oh, yep, okay. Can't beat that.
And so there's one other card that's less obvious that I want to try to put in here, and I've actually already tested it by accident because I already played this in an FNM event, and the store I went to didn't have 4 smallpox. They only had 3 that I could buy. So my replacement was a Satyr Wayfinder.
Okay. So, I mean, sure.
They both cost 2 mana, right?
They do very different things. One of them is like a gourmet steak, and the other is like 7 corn dogs in a baseball game. They both, yes, they make you feel better when you eat them. But one of them is much better than the other.
Yeah, the baseball.
I would. Yeah, definitely, Daryl. So the Satyr, we can agree the Satyr Wayfinder is the baseball game, right?
I mean, I don't know which one's which, in all honesty. Like, if we're looking at the deck this guy built, he obviously thinks his gourmet steak is smallpox. So, I mean, the Satyr Wayfinder might be right. I don't know.
Like, the Satyr Wayfinder was specifically the Brewers' 0-10 loss today to the Rockies on their opening day at home.
Yeah, probably.
All right. This looks awesome, Brandon.
Yeah.
How's this been doing? Oh, sorry. Go on. Yeah.
Yeah. So usually I find myself losing because, you know, one game I miscounted how much mana I had for a flame jab. So I retraced 2 times. I need to retrace 3 times, and I could have cast another spell. And sometimes what happens is exactly what Daryl said. You get to this late game and you're not grindy. You've grounded them down quite a bit, but now you just need a finisher. And so I think Worm Harvest is where this deck needs to be.
Cool.
So that's that.
Gotta love to win with an army of worms, right?
Yeah. So hopefully by the end of this weekend, I will be the master of those worms.
All right. Cool. Daryl, would you like to report back on your leg day experience? Your challenge was to focus on your drafting skills this past week.
So I drafted this Friday at Moxmania. I did the F&M draft. We fired an 8-man. And as far as drafting skills are concerned, this was pretty much like the non-tester of skill testers. Like, I opened the let me make sure I pull this guy up so I say his name right. The three black red gives all your guys come into play +2/+1 in haste. I can't remember.
Kolaghan. It's not Kolaghan.
No, it's not Kolaghan. It's like I'm gonna sound Boltwing Marauder.
Yeah.
It's a 5/4 flyer. When another creature enters, it gives one of your creatures +2/+1 in haste. So I opened that in my first pack and committed to black red, and I just went Kolaghan's Shrine. Ultimate price, and then I took a creature to try and fill out my curve instead of taking the 3-mana 2 damage to all non-flyers card, because I was like, there's certainly not an aggressive deck in this format full of dragons. Like, that makes no sense. So I promptly went 1-2 and died to 2 aggressive decks because I'm an idiot. But I had like 9 dragons in my deck and 3 shrines, and I played all my rares. Like, I opened the Boltwing Marauder. And then I opened Deathbringer Regent. And then the third pack was actually kind of the most interesting part of the draft. So it went Dragons, Dragons, Fate. So I opened a pack of Fate Reforged. I opened a Bloodstained Mire was the first card I saw, because I didn't know that there was like mana fixing lands in this pack. So I opened the pack and I saw a Bloodstained Mire, and I showed it to someone. I'm like, what? Did I open the wrong pack? I was confused. I had no clue that was going to be there. So I looked really stupid. And then I, like, looked through the pack, and the only other card in my colors was an Alicia Who Smiles at Death. So the question was, am I going to pick a 3-mana, 3/2 first striker that's on curve and kind of fills out my curve?
Yeah.
Or take the mana fixing in Bloodstained Mire?
Like, you take the money fixer.
I said no money fixers. I was in it to win the draft. I'm winning this draft. I don't care. I'm going to try and win. What do I take? And so that's kind of what I wanted to ask you guys about. So that's like the most interesting situation that came up. Because like I found out later, the guy to my left was also playing red-black, so there was no way I was getting either of these cards back.
Well,
and so
let me ask you this first, Daryl. Was there a Tybalt in this pack?
There was no Tybalt. That is the wrong set.
Also is in your colors.
That is the wrong set, unfortunately. So, but like, this is sort of the most interesting thing that came up was, you know, how do I maneuver this? Am I supposed to, like, is the correct point for winning this draft to take the 3/2 first striker? Or is the correct point to take the mana?
Well, did you say that you keep the rares or do you draft the rares at the end?
You keep whatever you draft. So, okay. But like, that's irrelevant. I was trying to win the draft. I had come into the draft saying, I don't care about the money. I'm going to light this $12 on fire for the good of the podcast. Like, okay,
appreciate that.
What am I actually supposed to do?
Daryl, it'd be really hard to pass up a fetch land. I'll be honest with you, I'd take that fetch land. But only because I could justify that pick for the good of the podcast by saying, hey, it's in my colors. But yes,
sure,
absolutely.
It was a literal
blessing. A 3/2 for 3 with first strike on its own is like a total powerhouse in limited.
Yeah.
That's insane.
I didn't have much to combo with it because like, there weren't a lot of 2-power guys in my packs. There were just a lot of dash guys. So there were, like, 2 toughness – or 2-power guys that I keep in pack. But there wasn't really a lot of targets. But it was just, like, you know, this. I felt like the 3/2 first striker was better than taking the fetch land.
Matter if it has targets for its ability.
Yeah. Like, I ended up not splashing white. I took a late Evolving Wilds and took a Center Soul and the +2/+2 white pump spell with rebound. I took both of those rebound spells like in mid pack when there wasn't a card in my colors, because I was like, this might be a splashable card and I can get a Mardu try in pack 3 if I get lucky, I think. Once I found out that the Mardu try was in there, but I didn't end up splashing for those cards because even though with 9 dragons, I thought Center Soul would be powerful enough. I didn't think the pump spell would be good enough because the deck was really just about surviving the early game and letting cards like Boltwing Marauder and Deathbringer Regent kind of take over the game. I did end up with a very interesting piece of synergy in the deck, though. I had an Underworld Journey, or Deathly Journey, I think it is. It's a 3-black-black enchantment. If you have exactly 1 creature, it gets +2/+0, Death Touch, and Lifelink. And so I got to play the combo game of if I ever draw with that enchantment, you use your dash guys to create attackers. Like, you dash, attack, post-combat play a creature, and bounce your dash guy so that the only guy in play is, like, your dragon that you couldn't attack with that turn, but you got, like, 4 points of lifelink in against an aggressive deck. So, like, I got to try and go back and forth with the aggressive decks trying to use that strategy. It didn't work out. I ended up going 1-2. I lost to aggressive decks because one guy was mono, like, green-white and had, like, 7 pump spells in his deck. And so he got to, like, pump spell, epic confrontation to kill one of my dragons when I had held back, like, 4 of his guys with it. So I just died on the spot. And, you know, those things happen. But it was kind of a very interesting experience to just see the deck come together and try and figure out, like, I think the most interesting part of the whole draft was, you know, what do you actually take in that third pack? You know, yeah. what's right as far as trying to win the draft is concerned. But there were a lot of the rest of it was pretty simple. I did miss another ultimate price in pack one because I took like another curve filling creature instead of taking another removal spell. And I you guys can go ahead and pound me over that one. I wasn't sure if I needed to like have a curve or if just like taking the best removal spell was just always correct because it's a removal spell. I don't really know because it's a common, so I figured ultimate price would come around.
Yeah. I mean, if your plan is to play a bunch of big fatty dragons, which apparently was when you drafted all those monuments. Yeah, you said that, right?
I had, like, 3 monuments over the course of the draft. Like, the first one was pick 2. The first one was pick 2 because it was in color. And then the second ones were just late in the draft. Nobody wanted, like, I took a green-red monument and then another green-red monument just because I had a bunch of dragons and I wanted to ramp into them.
Yeah.
I ended up playing a forest on the splash to, like, try and activate those monuments in the mid-game and late-game. But they never really they were never really relevant.
Daryl, there's this card in Limited, and I know we're not a Limited podcast, but it's worth covering there. It's called, like, Butcher's Glee. Target creature gets +3/+0, gains lifelink, and then you regenerate it. Instant speed, it's, like, 1 black and 2. Do you have that in your pool?
I didn't see one the entire draft. Okay. I did not see one.
All right, the reason I bring that up is because I remember that from the pre-release. That was the only other time I've done Limited with this set, and that card is insane. That is, like, everything you want a combat trick.
Yeah, especially for a deck like that where, like, all your creatures are, like, dash guys that are kind of bad on their own. Like,
yeah.
I had like a couple of the 2/2 camp lock flyers, but then I had like the 2/3 red guy, the 5/4 always attacks guy, stuff like that. So like I had just a bunch of like guys that weren't really good, but gummed up the ground enough to let, you know, my dragons try to take control of the game was sort of the plan. And it just didn't work out because I ran into three aggressive decks in my pod, one of which was also in my colors, and that's the one I beat. And then the other two were just like green, white, and blue, or red, green, and they just crushed me.
Yeah. So what'd you learn? How'd you become a better player?
I think a lot of what I learned is like not to sort of like how to draft. I always thought that draft was sort of this very curve heavy concept, is that like your cards may be really crappy, but if you can just curve out, you'll win a game. So like a lot of that led to like not taking certain cards in pack 1 and 2. Like I didn't take a second ultimate prize. I learned that the draft format actually has aggressive decks, which I didn't expect out of a dragon or a draft format with a bunch of dragons. And there will always be an aggressive deck in these formats. And then like, just always take the best card, which seems very intuitive. Just like if there's a card that seems better than all of them, even if you don't know the format, just take it because it probably is.
Right.
But so that, and like that sort of set in pack 2. I picked up that Deadly Wonderings when there were like a couple of on-curve creatures, but I was just like, I feel like this card's just the best card in the pack. Like I finally started to click late in pack 2. But, like, in pack 1, I missed out on a Deathwind and an ultimate prize and that Pyroclasm just because, like, I feel like that this format's a curve. Like, all the draft formats are curve formats and you have to curve out. Not just take the best card and then, like, put all the best ones together and see if you can just, like, slowly grind your way through your opponent's sort of board full of creatures.
So I guess there's something to be said about value over your curve in a way, and in a format where there's morph and mega morph and dash and things and all those things that seem overcosted and mana intensive, it goes a long way to be keeping that card advantage and really taking them down with that sort of strategy.
Yeah, it's not even the card advantage that I kind of missed out on. It was just like I didn't take the most powerful cards. Like I didn't take ultimate price. I didn't take like a pyroclasm because I didn't think there were like a lot of pyroclasmable creatures. So because of that, I missed out on cards that like if I were building a standard deck, I would be like, oh yeah, I'll put some multiple prices in, I'll put some pyroclasms in, because I know there will be people gunning to play small creatures on the ground, and there will be like there will be monocolored creatures. That's just the thing that will happen. But I saw like a lot of the bombs being dragons, and I figured I can use these crappy guys to go up the ground. And then since I have guys to go up the ground, then we won't really trade, and then I'll just play dragons and beat them. But then I got kind of overwhelmed by pump spells and things like that. So it's kind of like you learn that combat tricks are actually real, and removal is – I undervalued removal in draft even though I overvalue it playing construction. So it's like really strange things I learned.
Okay. All right. Well, we will talk about another challenge for next week. Then maybe we can put Xu Ming on something or John on something, and have them report back in the week to follow. So maybe start thinking about something that we can send them off on, and something that we can challenge them with. But ultimately, it is up to them to say, you know, what sort of thing that they want to focus on, or Brandon, for that matter, if you want to try one too, let us know.
Yeah. Sure.
Cool. All right. Well, we better wrap it up. At that, we are at about an hour and a little over an hour.
Okay. Should we do a little non-magic, what we all did this week?
Yeah.
All right.
Go ahead. You start us off.
Sure. So I get to visit lovely Winona, Minnesota. I'm up here this week for work, so I'd like to claim it's a vacation, and I'll be visiting my brother, who's a UW Wisconsin lacrosse university student. So that's kind of what I'll be doing this week / next week.
Yeah. So lacrosse is French for the cross, right?
Yeah. That is 100% accurate.
Okay. And UW is acronym for University of Wisconsin, right?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to check and clarify for our listeners who don't have the internet to Google these things in front of them.
Okay. Yeah. So we are in Wisconsin.
Wait a minute. They're listening to our podcast on the internet. What are you talking about?
Some people drive, Daryl.
Yes. Okay. Fair.
I like to be as descriptive as possible.
That's good. Yeah. UW is the University of Wisconsin.
All right. Daryl, how about you?
So this week I watched some sports ball. I was invited over to a couple of people that we know from playing Magic. They had a April Fool's gaming party, and then proceeded to watch sports ball for the rest of the day. But we played just a bunch of different board games and stuff like that. And, oh,
okay. I thought you got there and they were like, April Fool's, go home.
No. They called it April Gaming Fools. But we played a bunch of different board games, just stylistically different things, like Ticket to Ride, Carcassonne, Smash Up, some board games that I suggest, like, our listeners, you know, if you like to play games, which most of you do, I would assume you're playing Magic, give these a try. They're nice skill testers. They're sort of outside of your realm of typical Magic gameplay. And they are very fun to play with, you know, 2, 3, 4 people sitting around the table. So we did a lot of that and then watched a lot of sports ball and did some grilling. So, you know, the standard, what real people do when they have a life, you know, get out of the house and hang out with others.
Oh, is it safe out there? I don't know about that.
I'm not a huge fan, but it wasn't the wind hurts my face cold outside. Right. So because of that, I decided to adventure out and say, yeah, I'll go for it this time. But right. 6 months of the year, I would not suggest that here.
All right. Well, I had spring break. As I said in previous episodes, I am a teacher. And I got to sit around at my house for a week and do a bunch of well, I cleaned the house, I did the dishes and all that, but I also did some work on the podcast stuff, and I built us a pretty sweet website, I must say, and that is cardknocklifepodcast.com, so go check that out. And we put up a couple of articles from people in the Milwaukee and Madison community, as well as I think I've got some submissions coming in from some people in the Reddit community as well. So I don't know if that's something that we're going to do like long term, or it's just kind of an experiment to see how it went. And we got some pretty good quality stuff. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, let us know. You can send us an email. We've actually got an email address at the same name. It's cardknocklifepodcast@gmail.com. So if that is something you want to do, then you can send something there. But also John, who's absent today, made us a Twitter account since our stupid individual Twitters were hard to follow and hard to find. But it is @card_knock_life, and that'll be in the show notes if you want to just copy and paste that. While you're driving, make sure you're doing that at a stop sign, though.
Or are you telling me we might actually get a question section where we have to
ask questions from the listeners?
Also, hey, Corey, I got a question about our magic content.
Yeah.
Can we submit Tybalt fanfic?
No.
I'm going to have I'm going to make a new webpage for that. It's going to be cardknocklifepodcast.tybaltfanfic.horse, which apparently you can get a dot horse these days.
Oh, my God.
So stay posted for that. I mean, you might want to put like start your RSS feed for that now because there will be a Tybalt fanfic just pouring in the next couple of days, I'm sure.
No, thank you. So I made this joke off the podcast, and I'll ask you guys on the podcast, and we'll see if this actually makes it or not. Are we willing to read listener bad beat stories for $1 a pop to acquire dollars from the listeners for absolutely absurd bad beat stories?
Yeah, you set that up, Daryl, and we'll talk about that next week. Stay posted for bad beat stories, but yeah, I think that would be a good idea.
So the world must know. We'll start framing those dollars.
I'm going to start with my, I'm going to submit my Scape Shift blowout story because I killed myself in that match. I didn't even really get to tell it, but it had to do with a Spellskite that was so obviously placed in front of me and a Lightning Bolt that was pointed at another one of their creatures.
Oh,
hey, who knows? Spellskite can redirect that shit stuff.
So, but yeah, I'm sure that we can use all those dollars to buy nice things for the podcast, like microphones for those without things.
Yeah, I'm talking on my cell phone.
Yeah, so I mean, let's get poor Brandon a microphone. Like,
all right, that's it for now.
Okay, so what podcast are we, Corey?
What are we?
I think we're the Card Knock Life, and what happens here?
Where bad beats are always $1.
Oh, yeah, okay. All right. Bye.
Later.